I'm able to report that Edison Carter was pulled off the air. The incident has not gone public.
Are we certain the incident was connected with the blip advertisements?
Not yet.
It won't be so simple if news of this leaks out. My God.
Come on, Ben. The only people that inactive are pensioners, the sick, or the unemployed. I mean, who really cares?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Spending our money looking at how the Saudi royal family might be funding extremism. Then, they keep the report secret? With even the survivors and families of the 9/11 victims appealing this week to Theresa May, please publish this report into Saudi funding of extremism in the UK. It's becoming the biggest open secret in the world that the US and the British governments care more about their arms and oil deals with Saudi Arabian dictatorship, that's the royal family to you and me, than they do about keeping us from being blown up or attacked here in Britain. So this week we have a listen to former United Airlines pilot. He was pointing out the massive Saudi connections to the 9/11 attacks 5 years ago in his book, The Big Bamboozle. Before he and his two children were found shot dead in his California home just a few months after the book was published. Well, we hear tonight what no other UK broadcaster, so far as I could find, has seen fit to broadcast. An interview with the killed 9/11 whistleblower Captain Philip Marshall from just before he was forced out in February 2013 when he was found dead. Plus, trouble at Temple Mount in occupied East Jerusalem right now. Our sister show Dialect is on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, the future of the way domestic violence is dealt with in the family courts. Well, we hope so. Local charity Gender Free DV have uncovered worrying evidence of systematic bias in social services and the police. Too quick to apportion blame to men. So why is that? And how do they intend to change things for the better? That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we start this week, Martin, by having a look at this extraordinary appeal that's been made by the families of the victims and some people who were victims themselves of the 9/11 attacks, saying, please release this report, please, Theresa, into Saudi links to extremism. Because as we know, almost all of the hijackers, or alleged hijackers anyway, of the 9/11 planes were Saudis.
Well, I'm glad you said alleged hijackers, because it's not actually clear whether they were on the plane. So let's get the we need to
and
say
of course,
that sort of
Osama
thing.
Bin Laden.
Well, what about him?
Well, he was Saudi too.
Well, he was, and of course the Saudis are well known. Let's leave 9/11 aside for a minute. The Saudis are well known to be the supporters of Wahhabi, Salafist, Takfiri terrorism all over the world. And they have been since the 1980s. But of course, they've been working very closely with the Western intelligence services, including CIA, MI6, and Mossad. Mossad and the Saudis work very closely together. So, for example, there was an attempt to try and remove Prince Salman the other week, and the Israelis flew planes to Saudi Arabia to back him up. So, in other words, the idea that the Saudis and the Israelis are on opposite sides is wrong. They're on the same side, and we're on the same side with them.
And now,
and
if you
we support them to arm and train Salafi terrorists.
And if we wanted to read any more about this, that's actually a really good book about it all. It's called Secret Affairs, Britain's Collusion with Radical Islam, by Mark Curtis. Now, Martin, this does go back quite a while, but we're going to hear now from the House of Commons on Wednesday, where the Green MP Caroline Lucas brought this up, the whole business of the suppression of this report. I mean, you would have thought, wouldn't you, surely, that if our money has been spent on finding out how terrorists might be being funded by the Saudis and other Gulf countries, that maybe we should be told?
But
you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, the Prime Minister refused to make public a report on the foreign funding of extremists in the UK, despite pressure from all sides of this House and beyond. With survivors of 9/11 last night also urging her to make this report available, will she explain if her refusal is simply because the contents of the report will embarrass the government's friends in Saudi Arabia? Or is it because ministers care rather more about arms sales to Riyadh than they do about public safety in Britain?
It is absolutely nothing to do with that. There is certain confidential information in the report that means that it would not be appropriate to publish it, but my right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, has made it available on a Privy Council basis to opposition parties.
Martin, what do you think that confidential information, national security or whatever it might be, might, you know, what's she talking about? Let's have a guess.
Well, it's basically, one, the guess is that it's embarrassing for them, because the Saudis are well known to fund extremist mosques in Britain. They do it all over the world. They did it in Pakistan with the support of MI6 and the CIA during Operation Cyclone in the 1980s. And the madrasas that they fund, I mean, basically, because they're very wealthy, if you want to build a mosque and you go to the Saudis, they'll give you the money, but then they're going to try and control what you do and what's said in that mosque.
So let's have a listen this week to the former United Airlines pilot who was pointing out these massive Saudi connections to the 9/11 attacks 5 years ago in his book, The Big Bamboozle.
Our guest is Captain Philip Marshall. Your book is so well written, it's very articulate and it's clever and it's scary as hell. It's one of those works you just want to linger over because not only is it well written, but you can't believe what you're reading.
Yeah, it's really hard to believe some of this stuff. I wanted to talk about where I got this title from. It's a Carl Sagan quote that I really love. He said, "One of the saddest lessons in history is this. If we've been bamboozled long enough, we tend to reject any evidence of the bamboozle." The whole episode of 9/11 is just getting out of control. As I explained in the book, I was studying the Bush administration for probably 10 years prior to 9/11. I was knee-deep in the BCCI scandal. I was looking into the SNL loan. I was part of the Iran-Contra affair. I didn't know it at the time. I was in the Special Activities Division, which is a real gray area for people. I think most of the people that are doing special activities for these illegal operations aren't aware that they're actually in special activities. I was knee-deep into it. I was really getting nervous when I saw that W was running for president, and then to see the way he won the election with his brother counting the deciding votes, I knew that we were in big trouble. So it didn't really surprise me. By the time I saw the third replay, I smelled a rat. The good news for anything that's done in an airliner is that it's recorded. Everything is recorded. Every sentence, every word you say in the cockpit is recorded. Every move you make with the yoke is recorded. Every transmission is recorded. I knew that at some point we would get to the bottom of this. By the time they released the NTSB reports and the black box data and all that, they'd already given us this bamboozle that it was some ghost that lived in a cave on the other side of the world that had defeated our entire U.S. national security. So I started writing it back in 2005. I really started studying it then when I had all the information, and I put it together. Maybe it would have been, you know, who they said it was. But when I looked into the NTSB, when I saw the flight patterns and everything, it was very obvious to me that these guys had been trained very well. Some of them weren't even pilots when they came to the U.S. And when I found the Congressional Inquiry Report that was headed by Senator Bob Graham, very, very interesting. As soon as I saw that report, I knew that we had found where they were trained. And when the hijackers came into Los Angeles on January the 15th of 2000 on a Thai Airways flight from Bangkok, their movements for 18 months were chronicled by FBI agents, field agents. We could see that Saudi spies, as Senator Graham called them, were aiding these guys. They were giving them logistical support. They were giving them financial support, opening bank accounts. They followed these guys all the way until December of 2000. 80 pages worth in the Congressional Inquiry Report chronicles this. And around December of 2000 is when they went into a go mode. And the go mode was they all went out to the Arizona desert. There's a lot of documentation on that. They had FBI agents sending up warnings. Hey, we've got a bunch of Saudi guys out here learning how to fly airplanes, and I think they're trying to pull some kind of a terrorist operation. Those warnings were ignored, and we can see that there was three of the pilot hijackers. My focus was on the pilots.
Where did you happen to be on September 11, 01?
I just finished a four-day trip. I was flying up and down the West Coast for 4 days and got home around midnight on September the 10th. So I was exhausted. I was tired. My phone started ringing at 6 o'clock in the morning. I was thinking, I'll just sleep through this one, but it just kept ringing and ringing, and then I went and checked the messages, and I got all these crazy things. Are you watching this? What in the world is this? Are you okay? I hope you're not flying New York. And I had no idea what was going on. I turned the television set on, and I saw the building on fire. The North Tower was on fire, and I couldn't believe it. It's like windows were blown out of all sides of it, black smoke coming out, and I'm thinking, what does this have to do with me? And then I saw the United 767 strafing Manhattan. It was like a wild thought, like, what in the world? One of our pilots, is he trying to get a better view of this or what? And when he banked into that building, I just about jumped out of my skin. I could not believe it. How could this be? How could a United Airlines captain fly purposely into a building like that? And every time I watch that replay, I still jump at it. It just is so unnatural to see a suicidal attack with such a beautiful airplane. It was sad, and I started thinking about all my fellow pilots and had no idea who was in that airplane. And later on, I found out, and it's really sad. It hit our airline so hard. It hit us as employees so hard. It was very hard to see, and it hasn't gotten any better. But
no.
I vowed that day that I was going to find out who was behind this. And I can tell you that I am absolutely 100% sure I know who was behind it now. When I put together the tactical plan on this attack, there's so much evidence of aviation experts, and they knew exactly which airplanes to hijack, ones that were full of fuel going from East Coast to the West Coast. But when I put it together and saw when the airplanes pushed back from the gates, and they all pushed back on time, and they picked the perfect day, it was a beautiful weather day, there were no weather delays at all. The routes were very predictable, but the attack was designed to be done from the time they pushed back. An hour later, those attacks needed to be done. And when you see the two planes that hit the World Trade Center, those ones were executed to perfection. They hit it just right. There was no way that there could have been a military intervention unless there just happened to be some fighters flying over the area. Where this thing really, where they get caught with their pants down is the two that were delayed. Like United 93 encountered some delays on the ground at Newark before it took off. They crossed, they were 112 miles to the north of Washington at the perfect time. And for some reason, they continued on. Whether there was confusion with the hijackers or some sort of a malfunction, I don't know why they didn't take the airplane from that point and just drive it right to D.C. Because when we look at the black box recordings, when we see the navigational frequencies that were set in, they were set in to Washington National Airport. So that tells us that that's where that airplane was intending to go. By the time they took over the airplane, they were 300 miles to the west. And that created a delay. And it seemed that everything was set up for it to be done around 9:10 at the latest. And that airplane didn't hit until 9:40. So there was 30 minutes is an eternity in aviation when you're moving at 500 miles an hour. I think they were busted, basically. But no one read it. No one analyzed it. If they would have turned in right then, and American 11 that came out of Dulles, he too went 300 miles to the west. And when the cockpit was being taken over, that was about the same time that United 175 hit the South Tower. So there was plenty of time for scrambles out of Andrews and out of Langley that should have intercepted those airplanes. So when you see the president reading the pet goat, I think what he was doing is waiting for the attack to be completed. If they would have done it on time, he could have jumped up at 9:05 and started scrambling everything. It would have really looked like they were trying to stop it.
Is it your opinion Flight 93 was headed for the Capitol Dome?
I don't know if it was headed for the Capitol Dome. That's my guess. I do know that it was from the black box recordings where we can see where the navigational frequencies were manually entered into the navigation. We know that they were set into the localizer frequency at Washington National Airport. So we know that's where they were planned to go. What happened with that flight was that that's where they should have taken it over when it was 112 miles to the north. When they ended up taking over the airplane, they were out of range for that frequency, for that localizer at National. And basically that pilot got lost out there. He didn't have anything to navigate with. He didn't have anything to hook the autopilot up with. So you can see that how he made a couple other mistakes with the autopilot. He actually got up to about 40,000 feet, which is way too high at that weight. You can get up to 40,000 in a 757, but you have to burn a lot of fuel off before you can do that. And he almost stalled the airplane out 250 miles from the target, and he ended up crashing at 112 miles from downtown Washington. There's a lot of indications that people knew that this attack was coming. I remember watching the news that day, and there was media reports saying that the Capitol was the target. I don't know how in the world anyone would know that for sure. There's a lot of signs that people knew that it was coming, and there was a lot of back-channel stuff going on that was promoting this evildoer, this Osama bin Laden was getting ready to strike and all this. I think those were rumors. I think those were back-channel. It was a setup for the bamboozle, basically. They had all these reports, supposedly, that went up to the White House, and those reports kept saying that, oh, this guy bin Laden's getting ready to strike. And as an airline captain at that time, no one told me there was a threat out there. No one told anybody else that these threats were out there. So I thought it was really interesting. And when I looked into the evidence on bin Laden, you know, through the congressional inquiry who looked into it for a long time, almost a year, there's no operational evidence at all on bin Laden. They have 80 pages worth on the Saudi intelligence.
On the cover of your book is the seal of the intelligence community. Why is that seal there?
The intelligence community. You hear it a lot on the media, but you really don't know what it is. And I started picking up that whoever this intelligence community was, they were the ones in the reports that kept saying, oh, the intelligence community says that bin Laden is behind 9/11 because, and then there was nothing after the because, really, except for that he wrote a fatwa back in 1998. So that's the only evidence that's cited anywhere, is that he wrote a fatwa that he was going to strike the United States. So I started looking in, okay, so who is the intelligence community? We present this evidence of who the intelligence community is. They're every armed authority of the United States as a result of 9/11, as a result of the attack. They control the Department of Homeland Security, the TSA, the CIA, the FBI, the energy, and the big one is the United States Treasury. They have learned how to go around our Congress and tap directly into the Treasury. And those are our tax dollars that are sitting there as the grand prize for anyone that has taken over the United States government, is that they get to the Treasury. And they control the Treasury. From now on, anyone who reads this book will know the rest of their life when they hear in the intelligence community what exactly that is. And it's being run from a 1.4 million square foot building called the George Bush Center of Intelligence right outside of Washington. So the way I see it is that they have overpowered our government. They have overpowered the three branches of equal power with scare tactics. We got to throw all of our money at terrorism. So $15 trillion has disappeared since the time that George W. Bush took over. They spent every penny that we sent them in our taxes, and then $15 trillion on top of that. So I'm wondering, where did all that money go, and who's controlling that money? It's a pattern that I was studying before that. The BCCI scandal was very fishy type. They got into the Treasury, and billions of dollars disappear almost on a daily basis for the last 10 years.
So how did these guys do this, and where did they receive their training, and who arranged that?
That was the first thing that really raised the red flag for me, was when I got the NTSB reports and saw the flight patterns, and the black box recordings and all that are very, very accurate, and they all lined up to the half second with everything. So I put that together. I've got all the black box recordings so people can see. They can go in there and look at it. When airline pilots look at this thing, they go, holy smoke, how in the world did they know how to do that? So it's very obvious to me that they had a Boeing instructor and Boeing airplane. There was no doubt about that. For instance, I tried to fly the pattern of American 77, the one that hit the Pentagon, and I flew it 300 miles to the west is where this Hani Hanjour, who was the pilot, he was a Saudi guy from the same hometown as the Prince Bandar, who was documented as funding this operation through the Riggs Bank. He took the airplane from 300 miles west, made the perfect turnaround. Of course, that was a pretty easy one there because he was going west, so all he had to do is reverse course for his navigation. So then he came back into Washington. He came over Dulles Airport around 9,000 feet. He clicked the autopilot off at 7,000 feet, and you can see he kind of waved it a little bit. I mean, I can't imagine flying that airplane single pilot. You know, I rely on my co-pilot. You know, you're basically a two-headed, four-armed monster in the cockpit of one of those airliners, and you're checking and cross-checking, and we have all types of procedures that we're watching each other. Almost doesn't cut it in the airline business. You know, oh, I almost got to 7,000 feet. I leveled off at 6,000. Yeah, well, that's great, but you just killed 500 people. It doesn't cut it. But anyway, he clicked off the autopilot at 7,000 feet, and coming right at the Pentagon. He, too, had National Airport locked in on his navigation. So on a beautiful day like that, he could pick up the target visually. And when he did that, he came over the Pentagon. He was way high. He was at 7,000 feet. And the Pentagon's not that easy to spot, really, from the air. It's kind of spread out building, and there's a lot of other buildings in the area. You really have to know what you're looking for. Now, he came down 7,000 feet, and he did a steep descending turn and rolled out at 2,500 feet with the Pentagon in the windshield in front of him. Now, think about what was going on at that time. They just killed two pilots. It was a murder scene. It was chaos. It was, I can't even imagine trying to stay focused in a situation like that. But this guy had the situational awareness to roll out at 2,500 feet and started diving towards the Pentagon. And then he pushed the throttles up to the firewall. Now, when I tried that in the simulator, you know, I'm a pretty big guy. I'm 220 pounds, 6'3", 220, something like that. I could not hold the yoke down because those engines produce something like 60,000 pounds of thrust each. So that thing's climbing like a bat out of hell. I actually missed it on the first. I was 1,000 feet and climbing when I went over it the first time in the sim. It took me four tries to hit the building. And the only way I could do that was to start trimming the nose down before I pushed the throttles up. So according to the official intelligence community, this was this guy's first time in the cockpit of a 757. I don't think so. So that leads me to believe that, hey, somebody trained them. Can I find any evidence that someone trained them? Well, when I found the Congressional Joint Inquiry report and learned that as soon as these guys hit the ground in Los Angeles on January 15th, they were met by employees of the Saudi Aviation Authority. And they were connected to a company called Dala Avco, which is a Saudi operator, kind of a contractor for the Saudi government that operates Boeing airplanes. So that tells me right there, it's like, oh, there it is. I found where they got instructors from, and I found out where they got the manuals from and the expertise that was needed to fly this particular mission. My next step was, okay, now I need to find an airport and I need to find airplanes. And the FBI guys were following these guys out into this triangle out in Arizona. And I started looking around out there. They have these storage airports. The banks own most of the airplanes that are leased by the airlines. And sometimes in between these leases, they're parked at these storage airports. And one airport really started to stick out. It had 757s and 767s parked on the field in the summer of 2001. And it was a CIA airport from back in the Air America days. So that started to raise some red flags. And then on top of that, there was number three guy at the CIA who was appointed by W in June of 2001. His firm was the one that was placing all these trades on the airlines that went down. He had put options on two airlines, or he didn't, but his firm did. Jeremy Scahill is a investigative author that wrote extensively about Pinal Air Base out there. And that's where these guys disappeared to. That's where they were. That's where the FBI reported seeing them out in the Arizona desert. And at the same time, the head of the Saudi intelligence, the longtime guy, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, was in the area. He was up in Las Vegas. He was in the same desert. About 100 guys that disappeared, or they flew out about a week after the attack.
Quoting from the Big Bamboozle, a silent, confounding shift went unnoticed by most American voters. While Ronald Reagan gave great speeches with positive messages, accented with humor and perhaps the best timing of any politician in U.S. history, Bush and Baker slipped into the White House basement to build a covert government with CIA, DEA, and black ops assets. Today, this operation is called the Intelligence Community.
I have some connections that remain in the spook world. There's a lot of contractors out there. Blackwater is one of them. It's a pretty tight circle. Aviation's a pretty tight circle in itself. But this particular strain of pilot, we keep in touch, let's just put it that way. And I started getting hints of this Pinal Air Base from about three guys that work in that field. I have to be very careful about that because they still provide information to me. When I started hearing about what was going on, I actually took a little trip out there to just north of Tucson in a little town called Marana, Arizona. You can see it on Google Earth. Even then, it's very, very hard to spot. But there's this airport out in the middle of nowhere. It's a triangular airport that has three runways on it. And there's about 100 airliners there in storage right now. They're cannibalized if they're there for a while in the lucrative parts market. You know, but they're still airworthy airplanes that are ready to go. They're just in between leases. So I took a little trip out there, and I can tell you they've got some big rattlesnakes on the south end of that airport. At any rate, I did a little investigating of my own out there, and I looked around. One day I went out there, and I saw that there was 5 747s. This is a county-owned airport, and they wouldn't let me on the airport. They had a Evergreen International is one of the famous spook contractors, but they wouldn't let me pass the guard gate. I just act like I was an aviation enthusiast, just wanted to take pictures or whatever. So I talked to a couple of people around the airport that live around the airport, and they were telling me that many times people are trying to take pictures of that airport, and they'll send a car out there and confiscate the camera and all kinds of bad activities like that. But when I was out there, this was in about 06, 07. There was 747s, cargo that were being loaded up, and I have no idea where they were going. There was all types of Black Hawk helicopters flying around. It looked like LaGuardia Airport. There was so much traffic out there in the middle of the desert. The 757s and 767s were parked there. We have pictures of them. That's on our Facebook. We have a bunch of videos on Facebook that I think are really good. The Big Bamboozle is the page on that. And there's quite a good history. If you go online, you can see, if you Google it, you can see, look up the Pinal, P-I-N-A-L, Air Park. It's well known as a long-time CIA-operated airport. There's a lot of controversy about trying to shut it down years ago. People that are on the board of directors are CIA people. So it has a long connection all the way back to, like I said, Air America.
Why was this done? Who financed it? And who's the king rat who orchestrated all of this? I never thought it was a very good idea to have the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency become president. So you think Bush and Cheney were involved in this?
When we put the timing on the attack together and we see who knew what and when they knew it, the FAA knew about 35 minutes before the airplane hit the North Tower. American 11 came out of Boston. The FAA was following these guys. All of a sudden, the transponder went off, and this thing makes a beeline towards Manhattan. So there was teleconferences going on between Boston and New York, FAA headquarters. They were well aware that this airplane had been hijacked. And on top of that, Mohammed Atta, who was flying American 11, thought he was talking to the passengers at one point, and he was actually talking to ATC, which is air traffic control, and everything's recorded. He basically said, everybody, don't make any stupid moves and things like that. The controllers that were working that flight knew right away that this thing was a hijack, and they started calling people left and right. When I put the times together, when all these calls were made, Condoleezza Rice, who Steve Pasesnik, I don't know if you know who he is, but he's a real interesting insider with the State Department. He said it was a false flag operation, that Condoleezza Rice was part of it. So I do concur with that, because when she had a telephone conversation with Bush at 8:55 after the American 11 had hit the North Tower, and in that conversation, she was talking to him and said, all we know is that it was a twin-engine airplane that crashed into the North Tower. The only way she would have known that, and technically that's true, but if you say, oh, it's a twin-engine airplane, you're thinking a smaller, lighter plane type thing. 767 is a twin-engine airplane, but it weighs 300,000 pounds. For her to know that it was a twin-engine airplane, the only way she would have known that was because the FAA told her that, unless she had a eyewitness that just happened to be in downtown Manhattan and say, oh, you look like a twin-engine airplane to me. It makes no sense. Finally, they got her to testify in 2004. Of course, the media had already convicted the ghost. But at any rate, if you think about it, the only way she would have known it was a twin-engine airplane was from the FAA. And the only reason they were talking about that airplane was because they knew it was a hijack. So again, there's a just pants down type thing. There's no way she could have known that. And that's before he went into the classroom. He sat there until 9:02, fidgeting, looking around, and looked like a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. And then when the second one hit, what he needed to hear was that the attack was complete, and all he heard was that two had hit. So he had to stall. He had to wait. They must have been nervous. Whoever was behind this must have been sweating bullets at this point, because two of them had hit and two of them were missing at that point, and probably they didn't know where the other two were. So that, to me, tells me that there's something stinky about it. And before, too, with the 23 supposed PDBs that were sent up to the president, and he didn't take any action. He didn't alert airline pilots. He didn't alert anyone. It just stinks. And I think there was one reporter that asked him, hey, were you behind this? No one's ever asked him that directly, except for that time. And he just looked like a deer caught in the headlights when they asked him that question. It's online. I've seen it a few times. But it's almost funny the way he didn't know what to say.
Who financed this? What are the indications?
Well, again, the Congressional Joint Inquiry followed the financing that went to the hijackers. There was a Riggs Bank account in Washington, D.C. that Prince Bandar bin Sultan, you know, the good friend of, they call him Bandar Bush, he's so tight with the Bush family, he opened an account, and his wife had an account, and the Congressional Inquiry said there was unlimited funding from Saudi Arabia. The guy that met him in Los Angeles a couple of days after the hijackers arrived had seemingly unlimited financing from Saudi Arabia. That's a quote from their report. Unlimited. Seemingly unlimited financing from Saudi Arabia.
What's in it for the Saudis?
There's definitely a thread in all of this stuff that makes its way to Saudi Arabia. And before 9/11, I was studying this relationship between the Bush family and the Saudi government. They were definitely involved in the BCCI scandal. They were definitely involved in the other covert operation from the Reagan-Bush administration, which was the Iran-Contra financing. So there's an alliance there somewhere. It's power. It's definitely something to do with a lot of power. If you've got control of the oil markets, and absolute power is what they have over there, and absolute power is what the intelligence community is working on right now. And they're trying to outpower our congressional, our judicial branch, and the executive branch. President Obama has stated many times that he wants to prosecute this Khalid Sheikh Mohammed that's down there in Guantanamo. And right next to him is the Attorney General. So there you have two of the three branches right there that want to prosecute him. But for some reason, and they announced that they were going to have the trial in New York a couple of years ago. And I've been watching it really close, and I still can't tell you how that got derailed. But it's an absolute power type thing.
Closing Guantanamo Bay and dragging all those people into civilian court, they might sing about who's actually behind this.
Absolutely. You're a pilot. You understand situational awareness. You have to realize how you got into a situation to figure your way out of it. If we use the judicial system like Obama promised in his campaign in 2008, because I realized in 2005 that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had nothing. He has no aviation expertise. You're trying to tell us that this guy is the one that found holes in the U.S. military air defenses? That would really be embarrassing to some of these Air Force generals that have gone to military school all these years, that this guy figured out, oh, this is how we can penetrate the U.S. air defense. It's impossible. It's a big bamboozle. So if this guy came to trial, the lid would be blown off of this thing. and it would change Washington. And I think that if you brought this guy, you would see a lot of corporate jets flying nonstop to Argentina.
How were these pilots able to have so much time without running into some fighters?
If the attack would have been executed the way I believe it was drawn up, where these guys would take off in the first 15 minutes, got to altitude, and then just shot right to their targets, it was a good tactical plan. Two of them hit on plan. The other two delayed for almost another hour. It's very interesting that there was a competent response from the military at first. They launched two F-15s out of Otis Air Force Base out in Cape Cod, but they wouldn't have made it there. They didn't make it in time. So I think it's really suspicious that when the attack started to encounter delays, that all of a sudden there was a, seems like a military stand down until it got completed. And when we go back and look at what Dick Cheney was running the response from the White House, it becomes very apparent. There was a meet the press on that next Sunday, and he said that they launched more fighters and that they ordered a shoot down. But when we checked that, and more specifically when Jeremy Scahill checked that, and Philip Sheehan, who wrote the commission, there were seven logs taken on those conversations between Cheney and Bush, and none of them mentioned a shoot-down order or even a scramble. So I thought this guy, Steve Posednik, that came out after the bin Laden, that crazy raid that they supposedly killed him, he came out and said that he used to teach that at military school, that stand-down. So it seems to me there was a very obvious stand-down. And then as soon as they got the word that United 93 crashed, and that was the fourth one, then they launched some fighters. But when they got over there, only smoke was in the sky at that point. Everything else was done. So it's a really very suspicious that for that hour, we couldn't get one fighter airborne.
Do you sense that there is an encroaching police state and that this is just one in a series of false flag attacks that are designed to bring about a totalitarian regime, at least in contrast to what we've grown up with or what we thought we had?
I have my opinions about that, but to tell you the truth, I am not an expert in that area. My message really is that this was a Saudi operation that was probably covered by our Special Activities Division. But when you put it together and you see who is given this fable about bin Laden and all that, those are the same people who are developing the DHS and the TSA. Supposedly some guy in a cave attacked us, but grandma going through security at Des Moines Airport is getting shaken down. And it's troubling to see this systematic takeover of the government. And I don't know what the big picture is. I don't know what they saw down the road that may have been a bigger number, that may have been leading to something bigger that they stopped. I don't know why this attack led us to go invade Iraq, other than it was written in a, I don't know if you're familiar with the Project for a New American Century, but that's one of my pieces of evidence that's on our evidence sources. That plan that they came up with, it was a theoretical attack. They called it a new Pearl Harbor, and that would help America get into a war mentality. And it just seems that that plan, if you look at it now, 11 years later, is the same thing that's happened. It's actually transpired exactly like that. They talk about using predator drones and Blackwater-type mercenary armies. And it's so encompassing now because what it's done is given this great authority, this fear of an enemy that I don't really think is there. And it's given them a lot of power. There's a lot of hysteria involved when you go to the airport now. You know, they're telling you, look at your neighbor, look around, see who looks suspicious. We got everybody looking at each other, and now they're looking into our lives. And everything's being coordinated with DHS and the DMV now out here. It's very suspicious that it's the very same people that are telling us that it was a terrorist attack. They're the same people that are clamping down, and their power has gone up so much.
Now, that's Philip Marshall there. He's Captain Philip Marshall, author of The Big Bamboozle. The book came out in September 2012. And Philip was sadly found dead, shot in the head, with his two sons also shot. Officially, the police say, Martin, that it was a murder-suicide. He'd killed his two children and then shot himself, although the gun was found underneath his body.
Well, if you believe that, I've got a suspension bridge to sell you. Is all I can say to
that. So that was just 3 months later, after the publication of The Big Bamboozle. And this interview you just heard there was on the US show Coast to Coast in between times, obviously.
Yeah, does that sound like somebody who's about to murder themselves and their two children?
Certainly doesn't to me. It could also be that he's talking quite a lot there about his contacts within the black ops community. So there is this, you know, airline, these aircraft involved in all sorts of black ops. He mentions there Iran-Contra too. In fact, he even implies that he was involved as a pilot in Iran-Contra but didn't realise what was going on. I mean, is it possible, do you think, that someone could be flying from A to B and just simply not know what's in the back of the plane?
Well, if you were running these kind of scams, you wouldn't want everybody to know every aspect of what's going on. It's all on a need-to-know basis, for surely. I mean, that's how you'd run it.
What do you make of some of what he was saying there about these Saudi connections? I mean, he's actually joined a hell of a lot of dots there together, even saying that that there was this whole thing of unlimited funds by the Saudis.
Well, I think the idea that the Saudis had a hand in it is perfectly clear. And the Saudis, of course, are intimately linked with the Western intelligence services. The BCCI scandal was the CIA's bank. The BCCI was their bank, and they used it to fund Saudi funds to the Mujahideen fighting in Afghanistan, who were trained by British and American special forces. I mean, we know all of this. We know that we set up Al-Qaeda. Nobody disputes this. But what we're then told is we lost control of it. We set it all up. We trained them all. We gave them loads of money. And then these ungrateful Muslims turned on us, even though we were their allies. And I think what he's done is he's exposed a lot of contradictions in the official story. But I have to say, I don't think any of those pilots were flying those planes. The planes were flown, probably, to my mind, from the ground by Global Hawk technology.
Well, you're talking about the same planes that took off from Boston Airport?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite in the 1970s, the US had already developed so-called Global Hawk technology, where they flew a...
What about the passengers that got on those planes?
Those passengers are either dead, because they're just roadkill, or there's a suggestion that the one that was shot down or went down at Shankill, that in actual fact the passengers weren't really on the plane. Now, I think there are different levels.
What about, hang on, the relatives of those who died would take issue with you?
Yeah, well, I mean, don't forget in 1964, the Northwoods plan was that there would be planes supposedly bombed by Cuba, and then there would be loads of funerals, but the people wouldn't actually be dead, they'd just be pretending to be dead, and they'd even have relatives crying and saying my relatives are dead. Now, I don't know what exactly happened, but I'm just saying in 1964, the plan wasn't just to kill the passengers. In actual fact, the Iranians uncovered that virtually everybody on the Shankill plane, was working for the US military. Every single one. Now, it might be an accident that everybody on a civilian airliner happens to work for the US military, but it then raises a question, well, perhaps not. I think the actual detail of how the attack was carried out is secondary.
In his book, Philip goes deeply into the raid, which supposedly killed bin Laden, and he says that the evidence that's been produced is absolutely nothing, that this raid even took place, really. The photographs shown, they said, we can't show you the photographs because they're too gruesome. And he said, well, hang on a minute, because you were doing, apparently, for months beforehand, a surveillance operation on this, where you kept telling us that bin Laden would walk out backwards and forwards, and he would be pacing backwards and forwards every day. I mean, surely you could show us one of those photographs, and that's not going to be a gruesome photograph to look at.
Well, Seymour Hersh, the investigative journalist, has already questioned this, and he's the one, of course, that's questioned the sarin attacks in Syria and exposed the My Lai massacre.
But what do you make of his assertion there, that the thing that needs to happen with the 9/11 attacks is that they need to go to court? People who have been accused of it need to go into US courts. Instead, there's still some of them languishing in Guantanamo.
Yeah, but Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was eventually put on trial after 183 waterboarding sessions, and he supposedly confessed his role in the attack. Now, in actual fact, I think he's barking very much up the right tree here. It's quite clear that the Saudi intelligence services, working with the Western intelligence service and with Mossad, are the most likely culprits. And I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Okay, well, you say there's no doubt about it. What's your evidence?
Well, the evidence I suggest is everybody can see that the 19 hijackers were supposedly Saudis. Although what happened, the Daily Telegraph and the BBC reported the week after that various people who were supposedly the hijackers actually put their hands up and said, hang on a minute, I am that person and I'm not dead and I wasn't flying the plane. Now, that was reported by the BBC and the Telegraph and then forgotten about. It's not believable to me that hijackers got on these planes and took over the planes with box cutters and then flew them to the targets. He's also missed the point that they didn't fly directly to the targets. They flew around all over the place in airspace that's supposedly defended by the most advanced air force in the world, the United States Army Air Force. None of these planes supposedly were even intercepted. Now, what happens when the Russians fly a bomber towards Scotland? It's intercepted within 10 or 15 minutes. These planes fly around inside the most heavily defended airspace in the world. The Pentagon has supposedly got missiles in it that shoot anything down that tries to overfly it. I don't believe that plane was flown by Hani Hanjour and turned and crashed into the building. That all of the planes were flown by Global Hawk technology. But that's, in a sense, only a quibble. Because he's got the essence of the story, which is this just is not a believable story. It wasn't believable on the day. It's even less believable all these years later with all the evidence that's gradually been gathered. And, of course, the unpleasant truth is that the Saudi intelligence services and the Western intelligence services and the Israeli intelligence services are false flag terrorists. Always have been.
What do you make of his quote right at the start there from Carl Sagan saying that people just simply do not want to admit it, that they've been bamboozled? The longer a bamboozle goes
right.
on.
That's right. The real problem is not that people are bamboozled, it's that they don't like to admit that they've been bamboozled. So this is the people who plot these things are very well aware of how they can control perception of the people on the receiving end, i.e. us. And Penn and Teller would understand what we're talking about. The great Randy would understand what we're talking about. The great Houdini would understand what we're talking about. People's minds and perceptions can be controlled by those who have sufficient technique. And that's the purpose of it all. They're not just destroying things for the sake of it. You've got to ask the question, qui bono, who benefits? And the benefit was quite clear. The Israelis and the Western powers use this as an excuse to invade Afghanistan, Iraq, etc.
Very, very little
places
in the British,
where they wanted to go in
very,
the first
very
place.
Very little in the British press about this. Certainly this interview wasn't broadcast in Britain at all. There was no interview about the Big Bamboozle or a review of his book in the British press. Why do you think that is?
Because the press are controlled by press barons and the government. It's, you know, we've got an independent radio show here on community radio and we can investigate relatively fearlessly with our very limited resources. But if you want a job on the Daily Mail or the BBC, it's career suicide to ask questions like this. Career suicide. Although some people, like Simon Hirsch, have started to ask questions about things like the so-called sarin attacks in Syria and so on. I mean, following the detail, even for trained journalists and intelligence agents, with all the time in the world and a proper salary, you can't keep up with it all.
Well,
so
this
the ordinary
is exactly,
punters, I mean, who are spending most of their time watching Strictly Come Dancing and the football, are definitely not going to be able to keep
up
with it.
Well, so this is exactly pretty much what Philip says there. He says he's spoken to lots of journalists who simply say, look, we just can't go there. As an organisation, we can't publish this stuff.
Well, that's obviously the case. And that's because the control of perception is what this is all about. If you did this and you couldn't control the perceptions afterwards, it would be a waste of time. So that's why they do this. But they also want to control the perception of what's happened. So, for example, our contributor there, our dead contributor, has basically taken at face value the statements of the US government about the timeline and the events. Now,
National Transportation Safety Board.
Well,
yeah.
Yes, well, exactly. But the fact is, none of the hijackers appear on the passenger manifests of any of the planes. So they may be using false passports.
Well,
then
likely,
I'd like to know what names they were using. That's what the FBI finally said. They said, oh, actually, we know that these people did it, but none of them used their own passport.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a
ruins of the World Trade Center.
It's a bit of a quibble.
Unbelievable.
It's a bit of a quibble. And also, it's quite feasible that, because if you have a look at the traces, there are gaps in the transponder response. That is this little device on the plane that tells all the air traffic control people where it is. There are gaps. So it's feasible that at one plane, plane was flying along, and then actually another remote control plane took over it, and the first plane then just landed somewhere else.
Well, that's what is suspected. That's what the plan was in Operation Northwoods in 1964, is that the plane with the passengers on would land, and then another plane with nobody on would then crash into something or get blown up, and the passengers wouldn't really be killed, but they would then pretend to be killed, and there'd be funerals and so on. Now, if I was going to do something like that, I'd just kill the passengers. But the detail of how it was done is still obscure, but the basic pattern is clear. This is a false flag attack, like many others that we've seen.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
Also, a few other stories this week, Martin. The Turks are publishing US troop locations in Syria, and the United States are furious.
Well, the locations which they've published are where the US forces are coordinating with the YPG Kurdish forces, which of course are at war in Turkey. PKK is at war with the Turkish state. So this is the Turks, basically getting their own back on the Americans, partly for the attempted coup to remove Erdogan.
We've also heard today, just now, Sean Spicer has resigned as Trump's press secretary. He doesn't like the way the various staff that Trump's been picking.
So he's resigned rather than being sacked.
That's what it says. Often that means he's been sacked, doesn't
it? Well, I suppose it does. I mean, the fact is, it's a shambles, isn't it? And, of course, the shambolic US administration is being bullied along by the deep state forces we've just been analysed to do the things they want to do. I don't think Trump's directly involved in all of this, which is why they were worried about him taking over. But basically, he is a puppet by any other name. And he's not a puppet of the Russians.
Israeli general says, we won't let Iran win the Syria war.
Well, they've been supporting the rebels inside Syria all the way, including the al-Qaeda rebels. You know, the al-Qaeda that carried out the 9/11 attack? The Israelis have been helping them to fight the Syrian army. Oh, but the British have been helping them to fight the Syrian army as well, and so have the Americans. Al-Qaeda in Syria has been armed and trained by exactly the same forces that carried out the 9/11 attack. And this is what happened. And of course, we are told that after 9/11, we suddenly realised we shouldn't have been arming and training these terrorists. And then in Syria, there we are doing exactly the same thing again. I think it points to the finger who's really responsible.
Okay,
for
finally,
this.
Emmanuel Macron, the new French president, says anti-Zionism is a new type of anti-Semitism.
Well, he's just basically another puppet, isn't it? What we said earlier, the Israeli state.
So would you rather a Marine Le Pen had won?
No. I would have voted for Macron to keep Le Pen out. But I wouldn't have voted for Le Pen in the first place. I would have voted for Mélenchon.
So why is he saying this? Is anti-Zionism actually really...
No, it's not. As we said in the first hour, the State of Israel was recognised in 1948 on the understanding that it would remain in certain boundaries, including none of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was not in the state as given to Israel in 1948. And they may say, but it's ours. No, it isn't. It wasn't given to you. You have just taken it.
So what would you do as
Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, you had no right to be in Kuwait, you've got no right to be in Jerusalem.
What would you do as a young Muslim wanting to worship at Al-Aqsa in Friday prayers today?
Well, what can you do? If you can't go through, they're not going to let you through. You can't go through, can you? What I might do is join an organisation that was going to enter into an armed struggle against the Israeli state, which I would have every right to do under international law. It's absolutely clear in international law, Israeli occupation can be resisted militarily. The population have got a right under international law to kill Israeli soldiers.
Martin, it doesn't sound like you want peace in Jerusalem.
I'm not a pacifist, Tony. If we're going to have World War III, let's have it and make sure the bad guys lose. That's what happened the last two times.
It sounds like you're saying the sooner the better.
Well, I'm afraid it's too late now to back down. We're going to World War III's already started if you live in Syria. They've taken hundreds of thousands of casualties. It's not over yet, but the good guys are winning and we're not the good guys. The British military personnel in Saudi Arabia, several hundred of them, I'm sure they're all going to come home for a pension at our expense, but if a patriot was to manage to blow their brains out, they would be in the right and the British soldiers who are there would be in the wrong. I'm not a pacifist. Let's fight.
Well, I am. I think we should have peace instead. So maybe, Martin and I will
maybe,
not...
Maybe, Tony.
I don't think we'll agree
peace
on that.
Peace is not always possible.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Green Party councillor for Clifton, Jerome Thomas, former Bradley Stoke councillor, now UKIP leadership candidate, that's Ben Walker. Also thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment page is one word this week, bcfm.co.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with some music from 1975. That's Diana Ross. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.